why do we say it? You probably haven't been told this one, Mr. John, but why do we say it? It's a book of weirdness.
Weirdness like quotes and stuff?
Well, kind of, sort of. So we'll go, okay, this one probably isn't up your alley. Why is a gunny sack called that?
Why is a gunny sack called that?
Yeah.
You know what? I'm totally stumped. I can guess.
Well, that's what we do.
Yeah. That's acceptable around
Yeah,
here.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Then we're gonna do fine.
Take a shot at it.
Because they put little guns in it.
Okay. Gunny is an anglicized form of the Hindu and Sanskrit word gani, which simply means sack or bag.
Wow.
Because the coarse, heavy sacking and the bags themselves were once made on a large scale in Bengal, the material itself came to be known as gunny.
Huh.
And the bags became gunny sacks.
That's way deeper than what my guess was. All right. Well, I already learned something. This is good.
There you go.
Start.
For most folks, I think if they think of Animal Planet and anybody from our neighborhood, it's either yourself or the fellow that's out there chasing Bigfoot all the time.
Mm-hmm.
What is this process like? I mean, what is television like when you're dealing with this variable called nature?
Wow, I could go so many different directions with that question, but I guess I'll just say during the actual filming part. So my show, Wild Jobs, is unscripted. So I'm not sure what's going to go down when I walk onto the quote-unquote set. And the set is like someone's job site. So it's kind of like, it's built on the model of Dirty Jobs, where Micro would go around to just like regular people and would, you know, show their dirty job by doing it with them. And that's the same thing that I did. So I'd go out to these people who have dedicated their lives to animals, that have these animal jobs that are usually messy, you know, or exciting or dangerous, and I would do the job with them, totally unscripted, with very, very little research. So it's
like, you were kind of like the regular guy.
I'm the regular guy. Yep. That's why I got the shows, because I'm a regular guy, you know. And then I go out there with these other regular guys and gals, and they would just film us doing their job.
Why you?
You know, that's a great question. But probably because I'm a regular guy that's always had jobs around animals or doing wildlife habitat or working on fishing boats or being in agriculture, my degree's in agriculture. So I have this varied experience with animals from lots of different perspectives, from a conservation perspective to an agricultural perspective. And then I've been making videos about conservation, wildlife conservation. I've been working at the California Conservation Corps. And then one day, I had a video of me dancing, believe it or not, because if your viewers could, you're not viewers, you're listeners. See, I'm used to TV.
It's better. Theater of the mind, baby. Don't forget Osgood.
Okay, so your viewers, if you could see me right now, I don't look like a dancer, but I had, you know, you have to connect to people with where they're at.
Well, the ballet shoes do kind of give you away.
Well, I wasn't sure if I should wear these or not. Okay. They're Keen ballet shoes, outdoor ballet shoes. So, I wanted to connect to the youth, and so I danced when I was younger. You know, I grew up in the city, actually, and so I was, you know, familiar with dance, and so I connected with these youth dancing to their music, and it was videotaped. I was going to delete it because I thought no one needs to see a fat cowboy dancing.
Right.
And but
not
I
not more than once in their nightmare,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. Okay. But the core members that I danced with was like, oh, we really want our moms to see that. Put it up on YouTube just for, you know, a little while. So I said, tell your moms they have 2 weeks. It went viral, brought a lot of attention to me and the work that I had been doing around animals and conservation, working with youth. And TV production people look at viral videos. And then when someone goes viral, they look at the video and they look at the person for potential of doing a TV show.
Oh, so that's kind of like they're scouting.
Yeah, so they're scouting. So my viral video, my dance videos, so I did some other dance videos with core members, get hundreds of thousands, millions of hits. But the videos that I do, which are more educational, don't. They get very few. But those were the ones that the production people were interested in. And so that's what got me the TV show.
So they came knocking.
They came knocking. Several different production companies came knocking.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was really interesting. It was a shocker.
You know. After the third one, you realize it wasn't just family?
Yeah. And a lot of them originally, like, there was, like, the shows that wanted me to come on and dance, and I said no to those, like American Idol and stuff like that. I was like, no, I'm not going to.
Oh, you mean, like, really, dance?
Yeah, they just wanted me to come on and dance, and I was like, you know, that's not really what I'm about. What you saw was, I like to dance, don't get me wrong, but I don't want a dancing show. I'm, you know, darn near 50, you know. There's other people who are better qualified.
Yeah.
So when the right offer came along, and it was Animal Planet, I was very interested.
So the concept of this is just showing various career paths, different
yes.
opportunities that are out there that maybe folks haven't thought of?
Yes, that's what the intention is, to show these different jobs. It's also a lot of people who are just animal lovers. I think all of us are animal lovers, like, you know, like your guest this morning liked chickens.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of us who have these passions for, you know, animals. And so the show doesn't just stop with wildlife conservation. It also does a lot of agricultural animals. And we had an episode on horses. We had an episode on rattlesnakes. We had an episode on a wildlife hospital.
So not necessarily the soft, furry, cute ones that you have at home
yeah.
that you buy a bag of food for.
Yeah. We had one of those shows. Yeah. But most of them were, you know, either agriculture or wild animals, and people who do like rehab, like run wildlife hospitals. Or there was one woman named Ellie who has Montgomery Creek Ranch, who rescues wild horses that are on their way to slaughter. So it's the wild horses that the Mustangs, wild
the Mustangs
in,
yeah.
in the West. And there's a lot of controversy around those horses right now. And so I went out and worked with her for a day. It was fascinating because I thought I knew about wild horses. I did not.
Yeah, Mustangs are kind of a whole different critter unto themselves, aren't they?
They are, and there's so many of them. So there's 60,000-plus wild horses on our public lands. And whenever we catch them, and they're eating themselves to death. So they're wiping out the browse for cows and for other wildlife critters.
We'll talk about when we come back. KINS News and Information Times, 8:19.
Listen to 980 AM for the best music. ABBA, Neil Diamond, Barbara Streisand, Billy Joel, and The Fifth Dimension. The all-time best are heard every day, all day long on 980 AM. We are easy radio. Easy on your ears and easy on your mind. This is memory-making music, and you'll love the memories you create. Tune in and hear the best music. Easy radio, 980 AM.
News and Information Times, 8:24. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with Griff.
Griff. John Griffith. Griff.
Griff. Gruff. Griff.
Gruff. Griff.
Host of Animal Planet's Wild Jobs. Mustangs. Aren't they like America's horse?
Yeah, it's America's icon.
So there's you got that Americana wrapped into it. Before the break, you were talking about too many and kind of eating themselves out of their habitat. Is that the case, or is it the habitats being restricted because of various land use determinations?
Oh, you're right. I mean, that's the thing with any of the issues we're facing right now in regarding the environment and animals, is there's multiple stakeholders that, you know, all want to superimpose their belief on this limited space. I mean, it seems vast. We're talking about the American West. It's huge. But it's not when you talk about 60,000 wild Mustangs. You know, some of the things that are at stake is that it's an American icon. It's part of our, horses are part of our culture. And deeply. And people feel very, very passionate about them. And you have other people.
Ignorant, say, perhaps. But
maybe,
passionate.
Maybe. Yeah. You know, every passion seems ignorant. Every passion seems ignorant to somebody else, you know.
Well, I mean, you think about it. Okay, you got a car.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is called the Mustang. You got this thing called horsepower.
Horsepower.
Okay, you know, kind of the whole macho thing, the cowboy and the Indians. But how many people have ever ridden a horse?
Yeah, exactly.
How many people are scared
today
of horses?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, so we have this rounded, fuzzy image of something
yeah.
and really don't have a clue, kind of like the uneducated expert.
Yeah, on YouTube, all the
roaring around, yeah, expressing our opinions. What was the biggest thing that you learned about Mustangs that was kind of like the aha moment?
I learned so much. I had no idea that they were eating their way out of house and home and they were actually in danger of starving to death. I thought that the West was plenty big enough for all of them. It is not. I didn't know that they were being rounded up and sold to people who took them to Canada and Mexico, where they would be sold to Japan eventually and end up as horse sushi. I never imagined horse sushi. I should have, because I spent time in Russia. I should have imagined horse sushi. But I had no idea. So when I went to Montgomery Creek Ranch to film an episode with Ellie, she went and bought 180, 200 horses out of the parking lots of, at an auction of these horses that were on their way to slaughter. And she bought them. And then she bought a 2,000-acre ranch in Willows. And she took all those horses there and she started to train them to be adopted. And I thought to myself, when she was telling me that, I was like, so there's 10,000 horses born a year. There's 2,000 adopted out. We're not solving the problem. Adoption's not solving the problem. BLM takes them and corrals them and keeps these in these pens for their life. And it costs like $49,000 per horse. So it's millions of dollars of BLM's budget. So this is just...
Do they have the equivalent of a spay and neuter program?
You know, they want to do that, but it's unpopular. Their BLM is getting sued.
Well, I would think 8,000 going to the glue factory is probably right up there on that same list.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting in other countries that when they have wild horses like New Zealand and Australia, they round them up and what doesn't get adopted out goes through the quote-unquote glue factory. Americans, a lot of our horse people do not want that to happen, and they will put, you know, they'll file lawsuits to stop that.
But they don't want them to be neutered either.
And there's groups that don't want them neutered. So BLM is like in this really hard, you know, it's when you're trying to please everybody, you're not going to be able to please everybody. So there is a solution that came out, and I learned this with this episode that I did with Ellie in Montgomery Creek Ranch, where there's this drug, and it's the abbreviation is PVP. Don't ask me to say it. It would be so difficult. Paloma Zona.
It's close to PVC, but it's not plastic.
Yeah.
That's what PVP, I got
there
out
you
of
go.
It.
Yeah. Okay. So what they do is, and there's lots of people in Montana and the West that are good with a gun. So they dart these mares with PVP, which is a fertility drug. So it like stops them from going into estrus, going into becoming reproductive. And it has to be applied twice within a month, and then after that, once a year. And where they've used this, like even the wild horses on the East Coast, they've been using this, and in some BLM districts, they've done this experimentally. It's working great, and it's so much cheaper to the taxpayer. Instead of being $49,000, it's like $27. So this is the answer. This is slow to be implemented because this is government with all these different stakeholders all wanting the government to do what they want the government to do. But I think this is the answer. So Montgomery Creek Ranch, she just doesn't buy horses and, you know, try to adopt the young ones out. The old ones get to live on our property until they die. She's very much into horses. But also she helps fund these PVP programs where people go out, they shoot the horses in the butt, doesn't hurt them. They keep track of them, and then that way the horses aren't having babies.
Do groups like PETA and some of the other politically active animal rights organizations get behind this?
I'm sure they do. I don't know about PETA, but I know the
Humane... But not specifically
PETA. Yeah, Humane Society, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it is humane, you know, that we're controlling. And we should do this more often with other animals, too.
That's what I was wondering, if there's others as well.
Yeah, like other with species. Cats. And, you know, a lot of times we capture feral cats. Because outdoor cats just kill birds and kill birds and kill birds. And so when we have feral cats, no one wants to kill them. We have this affinity for cats. But at least let's spay and neuter them and then re-release them. We can find compromises that everybody's not going to be happy with, but at least it's not cruel. Same with the horses. The PVP is not cruel. There's volunteers who are willing to do it. There's people who, like, you know, want to go out there and, you know, fire a dart into a horse's butt. And, you know, most of them are horse lovers that are doing this and doing it on their own, you know, for free. And there's no shortage of volunteers at this point. So I think this is the answer. And that's what I learned during this episode. And I've learned something during every episode of Wild Jobs, which is why I loved it so much, just for the personal education. But also it was nice to have these solutions and meet these solutionaries and then put them forward and give them this platform to talk about what they're doing that solves these animal issues that a lot of us know something about.
Kind of give them a platform.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah.
With commercial breaks.
With commercial breaks.
KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:30. Here comes one of those commercial breaks right now.
Do as a community to make Humboldt a better place to work and live? The answer is to make sure our kids are literate, able to plan financially, move forward in their education so they are better prepared to enter our workforce, and become contributing and productive members in our society, community, and economy. How do we do it? Through the Decade of Difference Initiative. Visit decadeofdifference.org and find out how you, as a parent, student, or business owner, can help. It's the Decade of Difference. Be part of it.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:35. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with John Griffith, or Griff, host of Animal Planet's Wild Jobs. Griff, as you look at some of the different jobs, occupations, things of that nature, whether it's with the horses or with other scenarios, that's my big word for the day, scenarios, what sense do you have about the American population and our belief, our knowledge of animals?
You know, that is, there's so many different ways of looking at animals in the United States today. It's not as homogenous as it was 100 years ago. I mean, 100 years ago, or maybe 115 years ago, 120 years ago, 97% of us worked in agriculture, and we hunted and we fished. And we were close to nature. Even if you lived in a city, you weren't that far from a natural area.
Hey, you still had dirt under your fingernails.
You still had dirt under your fingernails. Yeah. Today, there's a lot of people who have never been in quote-unquote nature. I work with them. I take them camping for their very first time in the California Conservation Corps.
That's what I was wondering with the CCC. I've heard stories from buddies who are in the metropolitan areas where they'll take a field trip, and it's the first time some of these kids have seen a cow.
Yes. Yeah, it's absolutely true.
Which is just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Because they're so ubiquitous around here.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, we've all seen cows and, you know, have our comments about cows and horses. I mean, they're just kind of all over the place.
Yeah. And forests and fish. And
yeah, fish, birds, all that kind of stuff. But in, like, San Francisco, okay, you hear some birds in some place where there's some trees.
Yeah, English house sparrows and pigeons.
And people are, like, stopping. And you can tell that it's an extraordinary event for them.
Yeah. One of the weirdest things that happened to me when I first became a supervisor in the California Conservation Corps was I found a toad, and I was just going to move it out of the trail. We were building a trail, so I was going to, you know, gently move this toad out. And a corps member saw me doing this, and he's like, "What is that?" And I was like, "It's a toad."
Really?
He's like, "Oh my gosh, wow! I didn't know they lived in California." And then he's like, "Hey, come here, look." And so these young folks came over, and four of the five that, you know, that were around me had never seen a western toad. Now, I couldn't walk to school in the morning without seeing a western toad smashed in the street. You know,
right.
There were so many western toads. And so what I think is happening today is Americans don't have the exposure to the outdoors that they used to. They don't see things all the time. There's way more of us and way less of them, animals, except for like cows and chickens and the ones that we purposely make populate, you know, populous. So there's a lot of barriers. And so some people who grew up with horses and chickens and stuff know animals, have one relationship with animals. Other people who have never even seen a toad have a completely different relationship with animals, been eating cows their whole life, never seen one. I had a corps member, and this doesn't even sound real, but this is the truth. We were doing salmon habitat restoration, and he says to me, "I thought salmon was something that came out of the can." And I was like, "Well, it does." He goes,
"Can?"
But I go, "Did you know it was a fish?" Yeah. Out of a can. And he says, "I thought it was like spam." I go, "What do you think spam is?" And so there's just a lot. But you know what? Generally, I think most Americans love animals. We just love them in different ways. Some of us love to hunt and fish for them. Some of us love to pet and hug them. Some of us just love knowing they exist and we don't necessarily have to go out and do anything.
Kind of sounds like the park system.
Yeah.
Some do. Some don't.
Yeah.
Some just want it there in case they get the message.
Yeah.
It's time to go. Yeah. It's got to be intriguing when you think about all the various wildlife, whether it's in the air or in the water or anywhere else. I had a cousin of mine grew up here. He's in Montana. They came back. It was for mom's event last year, her funeral. Had never seen a banana slug.
Wow.
And they were getting all giddy about a banana slug.
Uh-huh. Well, they are
cool. We did not introduce salt into the equation.
Yeah, good for them. And here's how they suffered to death.
Yeah. But it was like snails and slugs because they, you know, when it ices over, those critters don't exist.
Yeah.
So it just is kind of intriguing. And I would suppose the size of our country helps to kind of accelerate that difference because there are those areas where they just don't have that much outside.
Yeah. And, you know, I always tell people, it's one of the things that I don't think people understand when they talk about animal issues or conservation issues is how much our population makes a difference. So, like, in 1900, I'm seventh generation Californian. So when my family came here, there was very few people. You know, some native people and there were some pioneers, but there wasn't a lot of people.
You didn't come with Sarah, did you?
No.
All right.
No. So my family came on stagecoaches. You know, it was a bunch of Germans all traveling together. And Manns and the Hans and the Springers and, you know, all these.
Booners.
Yeah.
Don't forget Booner.
Yeah. They all came over here and you know, and they watched California grow. Settled in Watsonville and Placerville. And some even actually lived in Humboldt way back in the day. And when I was born, all the way up until the generation that I was born, since I was born till now, the population of California has doubled. There was 1 billion people on the planet in 1900. There's over 7 billion people now. And so everything that used to not be a big deal and not have a big impact when there was 1 million people doing it, now there's 100 million people doing it. It was a big impact. And so it's hard for us to adjust our culture when, like, say, my grandfather went hunting all over Fairfield, California, you know, and shot his gun and killed all kinds of geese and ducks. If I tried that now, I'd hit somebody in the head because those places are populated. So things have changed, and it's hard for us to adjust our culture to realizing that it's not just me riding my, you know, ATV and shooting my gun. It's 1 million other people. It's not just me wanting to go out and bird and look at this rare bird. It's 1 million other people too, and you know, and we're putting stress on the environment because so many of us,
particularly when you've got areas like the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Okay, that has changed. Yeah, rules sure then has. Reflect.
Yeah.
Here,
less so.
We're kind of about the same.
Yeah.
Or in Wyoming, or in Nebraska, and a lot of these places that are considered rural by most people's standards haven't changed, but the rules have significantly changed because we're at that end of the dog that nobody likes instead of the end that everybody pets.
And a lot of the management policies for these big population areas are being applied equally across the board. So like
is another crazy thing.
Yeah. So involved. Rules that are like extremely important in the Bay Area and LA aren't really needed here. So there's that, and that's an interesting issue. I think that just those of us who, you know, because I'm a lot of things. I consider myself a conservationist and an agriculturalist and an outdoorsman. We need this new kind of stewardship where we actually have to be informed and get people outside. Get people outside, but just to, like, help them understand the reason why there are regulations on how many birds we can take or how many deer we can take or how many, you know, whatever we're hunting we can take is because there's a lot more of us. Even though there's a smaller percentage of people who are hunting, there's still more in number. And so
but come from fact rather than from editorial.
Yeah, yeah.
It'd be nice if we didn't use quite so many adverbs and adjectives and more nouns.
Yeah, there you go.
Just as a concept, particularly in Sacramento. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:43.
SoCal just got a whole lot closer. No, we're not talking about some big, scary geological event. It's way cooler and with much less tectonic shifting. Starting in June, flying to LA will be quicker than ever with United Airlines' new nonstop flights from Humboldt County. That's right, no stops between here and there. Ascend, descend, and you're landing, like in just a couple hours. So it's kind of like LA is just down the road a piece. So what are you waiting for? Check it out at flyhumboldt.org.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:46. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with Griff, host of Wild Jobs on Animal Planet, and more importantly, I would suggest, supervisor with the CCC.
Well, yeah, because that's my rent-paying job. That's where my heart's been for a long time.
Well, and that's, you're changing lives there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other might be nuance. Mm-hmm. You're changing lives with
in
these
the CCC.
Kids.
My life was changed in the CCC. I joined when I was 18. I had great parents, but I was a bad kid. And so when I joined the CCC, it straightened me right out. And that's
because you were doing, or the accountability, or the structure. What is it about the CCC?
Structure, the accountability. Also, it just got me out of my hometown. And sometimes you just got to get out of your hometown for a while. And so it got me out of my hometown. I was in the Bay Area. I was raised in the Bay Area and dropped out of high school and all these kinds of things and joined the CCC. And just like it was in 1989, the way we do today is if you don't have your diploma, you're going to get it. We're going to make you go to school until you get your high school diploma. You can live with us, but you're going to obey paramilitary type rules. You got to clean your room. You got to get up and clean with everybody else. You got to do things. We're going to pay you and we're going to take some money out of your check for your room and board, which isn't very much. So you can save a lot of money. Plus, we're going to provide you scholarships so you can pay for college. Or we have some college graduates that join our program to get the scholarships to pay back student loans. So the
trade schools work for that also?
Oh, yeah. You can use it for trade schools. So whatever's accredited. So the CCC offers a lot of different things to a lot of people. We're very diverse. Some people join because they live in a distressed community where there's no jobs and high crime or whatever. Other people join because they got a degree in natural resources and they need job experience in natural resources. So we have very diverse. A lot of people think that our core member population are criminals. We have background checks. You cannot be a criminal and join the CCC. So those of you who have family members who want to join the CCC, tell them not to mess up because we do background checks.
It is a privilege.
It's a privilege and it's an honor to serve your community and to serve your state. Most of the California Conservation Corps here locally, they're on fires right now. So they're out fighting fires or doing camp support for fires. We respond to natural disaster emergencies, floods, earthquakes, agricultural emergencies like mayfly. And so it really gives young people, 18 and 25-year-olds, the opportunity to get paid, learn job skills, get scholarships, and serve their community, which I think is a very, very important thing for young people to do.
I would think that there's a high degree of job satisfaction also.
Oh, yes.
So if somebody wants to get in, or more information, where do they go?
www.ccc.ca.gov, or just Google California Conservation Corps. We have recruiters. We have a local recruiter.
So there's somebody they could sit down and talk to.
Yeah, and we like to send youth away from their hometown. So we're going to encourage, if you're from home, but we're going to encourage you to go at least to Ukiah.
Get out of the neighborhood.
Get out of the neighborhood for a little
break
while.
Some stuff up.
Yeah, and then go out and learn stuff and bring it back to your community in a year or two.
Very cool. Hey, thanks for coming by. It was interesting.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
See everybody tomorrow.